welcome all of you to this seminar run by IDEA's brand new East Asia International Affairs Program. It's a particular pleasure for me to welcome an old friend, Professor François Gaudemont, from, among other things, Sciences Po in Paris. François has a deep background in terms of the study of Asia. He has lived and worked in China. He is working on the region in terms of security issues. He has built a fantastic Centre d'Asie in Paris, of which he is now the president. And he is also the co-chair presently of the European Committee of the Council for Security Cooperation in Asia Pacific. He also advises the policy planning staff of the French Foreign Ministry on East Asian issues. What particularly impresses me with François's scholarship is the breadth, is that you're not just dealing with China, you're not just dealing with the relations between the different countries, but you are dealing very successfully through your own scholarship and through the people that you train in the Asia Center and at Sciences Po with a whole host of different particular issues with regard to international affairs in the region, such as energy, such as naval affairs, such as a whole host of various economic issues between individual countries in the region, within the region itself, and between the region and outside powers. And it's that breadth that particularly impresses me, and we are going to hear some about that this evening. The title for François' presentation today is China and the International System, Joining, Contributing, or Hollowing Out. It's a great pleasure to have you here, François. We're looking forward to listening to you tonight.
Thanks a lot, Arne and Professor Westad. What you've just done is describe me as a useful gadfly. Right, from one topic to another.
With death. And a gadfly with death.
And you've also illustrated how fast the gadfly flies, because some of the information is now out of date. The European Committee of CSCAP, for example, has gone bankrupt, which is probably it has, yes. I'm in fact sad to report, because I was still managing to get some contributions from the French, but it became difficult from every other sort of European, which sort of, you know, if you wanted to have a lecture on why there's no European strategy on Asia, you could start by case studies such as Europe's lack of participation in some of the regional forums.
But it gives you some more time to do your own work, so that's the possibility.
Possibly. And I've been part of what I'm going to say today comes from an outfit which I joined apart from Sciences Po 3 years ago, which is the European Council for Foreign Relations, which is excellent at what I would call trying to pinpoint what a realist diplomacy would be for Europe, if Europe, of course, exists as such these days. One can always have a question mark over that, and which has had the virtue of re-Europeanizing me in looking at China and being a little more comparative. So I would say that's the new part of what I do. Apart from that, I'm terrified by the fact that I've picked a topic which is way too large and on which there can be no metaphysical answer. We all know how China manages, in any case, to give several simultaneous impressions on whatever it does. And that you cannot be monist, you cannot have a single explanation or a single description when you deal with China in international relations too. The culture has different strains. It's not a pluralistic culture, yet it manages to have different strains. So I'm not going to be the final judge on the list of possibles that I mentioned. Of course, you will feel that if I mention the hollowing out, which is slightly more original, marginally more original than joining or contributing, it means that probably I believe in the hollowing out option. I'm not 100% sure, so I want to present you a case for looking at today's China diplomacy in context. That's if This is a very simple PowerPoint, which you can disregard very quickly. The first reality is perhaps to start from the crisis, the world economic crisis of 2008, and what it has done to China's position and to China's international standing. If we only look back 2 years ago, one might have expected a strong social or even economic crisis in China resulting from a downturn in international demand. In fact, just about the only non-political scenario for ending fast growth in China was the external limits of global demand, and 2008 would have seemed to be a perfect example of a lower of an accident having a huge influence on China. Well, quite the contrary, China hasn't exactly gained, but has lost less than anybody else. It's the Walmart of countries, so to speak, at a time of crisis, and therefore emerges more powerful, more self-confident, and certainly more impressive to its foreign partners, particularly to its chief debtor, the United States. So that has been something quite impressive. At the same time, and particularly from a European perspective, perhaps if we were Indians, if we were Japanese, we would make some of the same remarks. They wouldn't take exactly the same tone. We have been faced with a phase of Chinese rash assertiveness, official assertiveness, irritation on a number of issues. For Europe, it's been largely symbolic and focused on the Tibet Dalai Lama issues and on the diplomatic treatment of Europe. The cancellation of a summit in December 2008 is not exactly the first time that China walks out on a meeting, but at that level, yes, on a multilateral level, if you exclude the World Communist Movement, which you know so much more than I do, that qualifies as a first. And I would say it has systematized a practice of interrupting relations with governments over some symbolic issues, and it's going down to the hilt in Europe, including with countries like Denmark, who were getting away with a lot previously in their relations with China. There is no doubt that it has raised its military profile. In general, that may be part of a long-term trend, and it may be seen as a long-term acquisition process, as a self-strengthening process, which is a historical perspective. You cannot pinpoint a particular event, although I would claim that new assertiveness within the first island chain of the Western Pacific, the USS Impeccable incident, the new ASAT test in January 2010, which is much more impressive than the previous test because it's technically much more of a feat than the previous test. Well, that's something that's happened. To me, almost as impressive because I see it as an area that's very close to international relations. We've had a series of official gestures on human rights in China, which of course address the leadership's concern towards stability and the potential loss of legitimacy if you allow pluralistic debate. But to me, it's almost as directly tied to foreign relations because at time China has seemed to do exactly what foreign partners were telling it not to do. That is, it seems to have added in a contrarian mode as a way to emphasize its sovereignty and legitimacy. So unquestionably, we have had something of a new trend. Some of you, and certainly Arne, know that people connect it sometimes with a domestic political debate, even with succession issues again in 2012. There has been forms of competitive nationalism which have appeared recently among leaders, and some of the loss of control issues may have been used within leadership. I'm personally, I'm an old fan of intra-party factional debates and pre-89 history of the PIs and of their ideological content. I tend to see this today as history, as old hat, that if there are factions, they are much more personal, they are much more directly interest driven, they are much more mobile also than they were 20 years ago. And I tend to think that it's also part of China's public diplomacy and of the public diplomacy of some of China's leaders, particularly Wen Jiabao, both inside and outside China, to regularly sell himself as the least worst guy you could have around the block. That is, he constantly reminds the Chinese and foreigners that it could be much worse and that he's, after all, everybody's best option. So I don't call it exactly a factional debate looming for the succession in 2012. This has produced an opinion shift which is particularly strong in Europe. And you know, opinion polls are interesting. It's extremely interesting to note that there is a complete disconnect between the trends as they're perceived in Europe and some trends as they're perceived by whatever we can know of Chinese public opinion. European public opinion believes that China is both authoritarian and aggressive, and that this is all part of a transformation towards a risky policy. Look at the latest wave of opinion polls collected by Chu Yunhan from Taiwan and Andrew Nathan from Colombia on second wave, what they call the second wave of democracies in East Asia, and you'll find the extraordinary result, which apparently is not doctored. I've tried to talk to them and to assess how they collect their data, how they sample in China, and although, like everybody, at some point they rely on local police to for household registers, they do it themselves. They don't subcontract the polls they do. And the result is fascinating. It says that among East Asians, the Chinese are the people who are most commonly persuaded that they have a democratic system that works. And they're also, within East Asia, the country where the highest number of people says they would reject an authoritarian alternative. So here we are with at least a sampled section of the Chinese who don't feel bad at all about the present political situation, who don't see what we perceive in China. That, I think, is important. It will lead me to some conclusion on the connection between domestic politics and foreign policy. But for the time being, where should we look at for models, for patterns to try and explain how the Chinese are behaving today? I would add that reason that today we should sort of walk over the first 50 years of the PRC and particularly the Cold War era and move back through times to find models and guides of behavior for how the Chinese are thinking in terms of international strategy and what kind of tactics they use. And as I said, even if it's not a pluralistic foreign policy, it's a policy that's made up of many different strains. One of them, from the Ming era, is the mixture of soft and hard policy in dealing with foreign partners. And another legacy from the Ming era, which we don't always think of, is what I would call the legacy from the first globalization in human history, when China was a net surplus exporter of wares, which we all wanted, and when it acquired silver from the American mines through Europe and became, how would I say, a hoarder of silver, very much as today it is a hoarder of U.S. dollars. China was not really reaching outwards at the time, although you can argue about explorer and naval expedition and so forth, but yet it was not only, as some have said, a large chunk of the international economy by itself in an isolated way, but it was actually drawing from the international system while remaining essentially separate in many aspects. From the Qing era, we have something which is going very strongly today, and which has been a common strain for Republican China and for Communist China, but which is perhaps even stronger today in Communist China, which is what I would call the nationalization of China, the building of the national identity myth and history. And that is something we usually receive it from our Chinese friends via the humiliation narrative. The West meets China and oppresses China, and China has suffered. But in fact, that nationalization narrative, as people like Peter Perdue and others have quite convincingly demonstrated, had been built up in relation to China's policy and attitude towards Inner Asia and towards the second legacy of the Qing era, which is, I will use an expression that's really translated from the Japanese, inner colonization or domestic colonization. We colonized the world. They brought in surrounding areas into their national community. The Japanese did it, but the Chinese did it even more extensively. And that process of internal colonization is not over. It's still happening in Xinjiang. It's still happening in Tibet. The Chinese see it as a long, drawn-out process of digesting neighboring aliens. Divide-and-rule policies were, of course, inaugurated by the Qing in the context of Inner Asia, in fact, then applied unsuccessfully to the West. This is the unsuccessful legacy. The British invented the MFN close, so to speak, and the US perfected its open door policy. Even today, there's a very good case to make that the US policy towards China is essentially a rehashing of the 1900s open door policy. So these are influences. From the Republican era and from the analogy with Japan, I think we have to think about trends which may have come back, and concepts, frames of mind. If you look at the Republican, at the Chiang Kai-shek, from Sonia Sen to Chiang Kai-shek side of things, you have extensive belief into the international order as a legal order. China's consummate practice of the time of the League of Nations. It was a defensive use, but it trained dozens of lawyers, of diplomats, ably, and made its case, and worked painstakingly to protect its sovereignty. In fact, I would talk about legal sovereignism as an inheritance of the Republican era. Then Chiang Kai-shek, one must say, became much more successful in the divide-and-rule policy in dividing barbarians than the Qing had been. He played different sides of the street in the West, and he did manage to get rid of a number of unequal treaties and concessions later, perhaps, than the Japanese and the Koreans. But still, he made it. The reunification of China, started by Chiang Kai-shek before Mao would apply it to Chiang Kai-shek, which is a very strong trend on irredentism, lost territories, and claiming this back. These are all powerful images from the past, which I think are fused together in today's foreign diplomacy. There is another powerful analogy, which I think is even more compelling, which is not to compare China with the Japan of the 30s, with militaristic Japan, which is sometimes done in the US by what I would call, you know, out-and-out advocates of the power balance and China threat and geopolitical competition theory, but to compare it with the Japan of the early 20s, the beginning of the Taisho democracy era, when things in Japan were far less fixed, were far less set, when the future was still open. And you find, in fact, in Japan at the time, a belief in the League of Nations, just like in China. It's not rooted in the same principles of legal sovereignism. It's rooted in feelings, in claims for idealism, for equality among nations, among races. And it was a powerful engine for Japan to be a founding member of the League of Nations before it left it, of course, in 1932. And the contrary trend, which Akira Irie, I think, has coined about Japan as what he called, and I don't speak Japanese, so you will maybe, it's mushiso, it's a valueless foreign policy, a foreign policy without values, which he coined about the Japan of the early 20s by describing a utilitarian, pragmatic, interest-led policy that was also close to belief about social Darwinism, you know, the survival of the fittest among nations, but which is not yet imperialism or hegemonism. It is a frame of mind about, you know, catch what you can. And Japanese policy of the 1920s was very close to this dilemma between an idealistic but abstract view of a common international system, think about harmonious society today, and democratization of international relations, which I've yet to figure out what it really means, but these are general themes, and the much more practical and opportunistic trends of foreign policy. But the analogy with the Japan of the 20s, I think, goes deeper, because if you look at the international situation, at Japan's relations with Britain in part and with the West more generally, but it's particularly true with the former allied Britain, you have this extraordinary oscillation of Britain between containment and appeasement, if we use contemporary words, this extraordinary hesitation of the West towards Japan, which means that Japan was neither there neither here nor there, and in the end was probably incited to move further into a policy of strength and a relationship of strength. We have had in the past decade a similar situation in the West's attitude with China. I've elsewhere written on EU policy on China. The EU policy on China is all engagement and no insurance, no hedging, and that's of course a big defect. But for every realist power that has dealt with, and particularly for the US, there's been far more hesitation and oscillation. We have rationalized it because we're political sociologists. We rationalize it very easily into domestic factors and the election cycle, for example, in the US, and smart observers of American policy in China usually buy those sort of explanation. But if you are a slightly more neurotic leader who is used to power conflicts and he's perhaps less trustful in human nature, you might well see it differently as a new type of strategic hesitation. Is it by accident that in the first months of the Obama administration, when people like Jeff Bader and Ken Liberto were talking about what was the main problem between the US and China, they used the phrase, they repeatedly used the phrase strategic mistrust, which is very close to this notion which I outline. And I will skip a few passages, but I'm tempted also by an analogy with the post-World War I period, which is from an old Austro-Marxist theoretician, Karl Kautsky, who in competition with Lenin at the time forged the notion of stabilization of imperialism. That is, he explained that there could well be a compromise between the predominant imperialist powers of the time that would build stability, not at all based on multilateral, what we would today call multilateralism, or the international system, but just on a very calculative recognition of each's interest in keeping the system more or less in place. And of course, the failure of the imperialist stabilization of the early post-World War I era is what brought on the Pacific War and the rest. I say this not completely by accident, but because I happened to sit in Singapore at one of those often dreary Shangri-La ISS dialogues. I say dreary because it's full of heads of states and governments, and you're there, and you listen to their cut and paste speeches. But sometimes things come through, and I was there in 2003 when Paul Wolfowitz, the well-known conservative who was the point man for Donald Rumsfeld, for the first time through the olive branch, so to speak, to China, the first time for the G.W. Bush administration. And the key word for Wolfowitz was the search for stability in Asia. That was a word that the U.S. did not use previously. The word stability doesn't ring either. It doesn't register either with the range of U.S. interest, nor does it register, of course, with Wilsonianism or idealism. It's quite the contrary. And when I close my eyes, I leave this session of May 2003 when I first heard it, and I arrive to the Obama visit in Beijing in November 2009, and I see Obama, the starry-eyed idealist from the election, the left of the Democratic Party, and he's signing on a communique with China about the core interests of the two countries, voiced in and couched in similar, not in exactly identical terms. I tend to think that this ideal or this illusion of stabilization among realist powers has progressed a lot in the past few years. Now, I'm not going to go further into this historical analogy, which has already lasted too much. I'm going to come to the conclusion for our topic, which is that there has been a positive phase when China needed to join to integrate the international system and when it made concessions. These concessions were often made when China felt weak. I look at Taylor Fravel's famous explanation of China's stance on border negotiations and reaching a compromise, and Taylor Fravel's explanation, which I think he made the mistake of extending in the future, of turning it into a predictive model when it was not. But it stands very well if you accept the notion that this is what China did when it was weak. Compromised a hell of a lot more than we think, and reached settlements just to be in peace. And you might add that joining the NPT, joining the comprehensive test ban, things that even India didn't do, for example, were on the advanced edge of this period when China needed to join. Perhaps the ultimate concession that China made was during the final negotiations the WTO finally reached in 2001, because that is when China demonstrably ceded more ground than almost any other major new participant into GATT, which had preceded WTO, and that was clearly when China wanted to achieve something, wanted to reach a goal. On that historical period, which extends probably from, you could say 71, 72 if you want, but at least 78, to perhaps 2001 WTO, perhaps 2003 Iraq, which is the moment when China perceives that the U.S. is going to weaken, is going to be held up by what happens in the Middle East. After that moment, we see far less concessions to the international order. we see an unspoken change of attitude. It is partly unspoken because some of the concepts, some of the ritual, in particular of Deng Xiaoping's celebrated dictum and biding one's time and waiting, and so forth, still stands. It took me years to understand the rise in 2002-2003 of the debate on the Pacific rise of China, which at the time to me was something foolish. I did not understand. I did join, in fact, workshops in China, including with some of the promoters of this debate. I completely failed to understand, because every time they understood it, they were talking about their domestic problems and how China was, you know, big and too populated and had economic imperatives. I said, yeah, we all know that, but how does it dictate a foreign policy? I missed the point. This was, I think, the moment when China was turning inside out, when China felt strong enough that its foreign policy would no longer be dictated by joining a system, but by having to accommodate larger powers, but that was the moment when it would be dictated by its own necessities, its own interests, its own tempo, which did not mean necessarily confronting more, which didn't necessarily mean being revisionist about the system, but which meant no longer ceding ground. And that is very impressive. The irony is that from the era 78-01, many academics, including highly, highly, highly respectable people, have built a predictive model of China learning, integrating, converging. And politicians, particularly in Europe, who read academics rather quickly and painlessly, have turned it into a kind of shibboleth, a kind of self-explaining motto for the relationship with China. And we've also got into a system of relationship where we need China more and more, for obvious reasons. The U.S. needs it not only for financial purposes, but for stability, precisely. We Europeans need it slightly less on the financial issue, but we need it as a peaceful partner, because we have no other option from our point of view. We are a post-modern, post-conflict continent. And so that illusion has grown and grown with China, occasionally feeding us tidbits that encourage us to believe that the system is going on. And I'm very struck by recent, what I would call tactical policy cycles. I don't have enough time to go back over examples I would like to cite, but I will just use two from this spring, from this year, because that will be easier for a debate, for a discussion if we have it. The Iran situation and the Zhenminbi reevaluation situation, which are just two recent sectoral themes which have given rise to some speculation since February. After a year of rather hardline nationalism in its most of its foreign policy endeavors, and some tough relationships with the EU, which is very easy, but even with the US, the Obama visit last November was what I would call, for the first time, the Europeanization of U.S. foreign policy to China. President not treated so well, censorship on some things that he wants to do in China, and a huge pointless communique that goes on pages and pages about things which we are going to do, which looks exactly like the EU Commission way of trying to reach common understanding with China, but when you work from one summit to another, you see that there is no logical sequence. It's just usually for the sake of the summit, and I'm sorry to report. There was this very tough year. And suddenly in February, China gives us two hopes, one on Iran, where people generally expect that it's going to get to it's going to be more responsive on sanctions, that it's going to be more attentive on preoccupations of the international community. And one on the Renminbi, with the announcement on the widening of the exchange band, which everybody translates into a perspective of quick reevaluation of the currency. At last, they're giving in, you know, after 2 years of essentially riding over the global crisis. And in both cases, for Iran, we have an official spokesman in Beijing who will talk about it. And for the Renminbi, we have the unofficial members of official councils who give interviews that lead us to believe that, yes, you know, these are swallows in the spring. The revaluation is going to come. And then the cycle ends. In both cases, never ended indefinitely. It may reopen again. We now know that, at least for the time being, and with the excuse of the European monetary trouble, China will not consider reevaluation, and we see a kind of flurry of different attitudes on the part of the leading American figures who have to deal with this new reality, while they had banked for several months on China turning the page and opening a new leaf in the book of its monetary relations with the U.S. And we have what I believe is also stalling on Iran, as there has been stalling on North Korea. On this, I would encourage you to read a recent study by the ICG, by the International Crisis Group on China and Iran, which is almost too perfect. I was discussing with Arne, because the person who has done the study has managed to get literally all the realist explanations from Chinese experts on why they won't move on Iran. So in a way, it's almost too good to be true that the Chinese experts fall over themselves to explain privately why it can't be done, you cannot move China. I feel that it is part of a dual pattern of China's public diplomacy, which can be very open and smiling and talking about dialogue, and in private, in behind, have very tough explanations on why realism prevails. This leads us to a new phase. We don't need to shout that the Cold War is back, although Arne might enjoy it and may defend it, but I don't think that's the case.
I like it as history, fortunately.
Yes, probably, yes. It's too precious as history to be wasted on us as contemporaries. I don't think this is of necessity a proof that China is moving into a phase of hegemony, or a phase of challenging the international system per se, or in a phase of revisionist claims. Even when we are talking, and I haven't done that because there wasn't time, relations with Japan, the policy cycle that's been happening since 1998 and which never seems to be finished, it's reasserting itself regularly, or the new policy cycle that seems to be appearing with India. They're perfectly good explanations, tactical, opportunistic, short-term, political, more than deeply strategic and historical, on why China behaves the way it behaves. It behaves the way it behaves because it's an excellent bargainer, it's an excellent haggler, it's supremely realist, it senses weakness, it uses them, but it doesn't mean that it wants to destroy the market, to kill the opponent, and to become the one and only sovereign nation state in the 21st century. However, we have to face to a reality which brings me back to the Ming and to the silver, to the analogy of the silver trade versus teaware, Chinaware and tea leaves, which is, you cannot call it a historical strategy because it's a strategy that has no end. If you are into history, you have to think of an end, you have to think of a term. But you can talk about an innate tendency to work alongside the international system, chipping away at it, discarding it when it's inconvenient to your own interest or to your sovereignty, joining in and contributing at least as lip service when it's useful, certainly not feeding resources into it, letting the costs of the international system bear on others, and at this time, you know, the club of indebted countries, which is the industrialized world, is still carrying the cost of the international system, in essence, while it's viewed from a Chinese perspective, it's broke. It's financially broke. And that it's the expectations which some books and some authors now propagate, that China ultimately wants to appear from behind, to lead and to take charge of the international system, I think are totally inconsistent with Chinese mentality. I would not even venture the guess, the historical guess, that the Chinese leaders are in a Leninist way waiting for us to fall, waiting for our systems to fall. I think they don't know accurately what they're doing. They're just hyper-cautious, hyper-defensive, hyper-non-contributing, and very much as the Japan of the early 1920s, which believed it was the underdog coming from behind and had a long way to go before it would reach genuine equality with the West, they feel they are both historically legitimate to do this, and that it will be bearable by the international system because they know their own weaknesses and sometimes, in fact, underestimate their strengths or their impact. So, in essence, we have moved from a period of joining the international system to what I would indeed call a period where China contributes to the hollowing out of the international system. This is not the end of history. There will, if we pursue this logically, were the international system to fall, China would be one of the first victims of this fall of the international system rules and norms, which is why I call it an anhistorical policy, because if the Chinese go through, you know, the ultimate implication, they cannot afford to maintain forever that attitude. Something has to give. Either they have to be to wield less power and influence per se, or they have to contribute more. But at the present time, in this lull, in this interval where uncertainty reigns internationally, they still think it's their best option, and we had better consider the implications of this, what I would call, from a very old French description of attitudes at the UN, the empty chair doctrine. Actually, somebody is sitting on the chair. China is sitting on its chair, but it's still behaving as if this was an empty chair in many areas. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Franco. Thank you very much indeed. This was so wonderfully realist that I'm tempted to do the liberal institutionist approach, just as a summary for people who are here, so that before we get the debate started. But I'm not going to do that, because there are people here who can do that far better than me, in part because they believe in it much more strongly than what I do. I'm going to ask you a question about exactly where you ended up, about aims, about strategies and perspectives for the intermediate run, say 5 years down the road, when the new leadership is a couple of years into its period of rule. What is it that the Chinese leadership is aiming for? You were saying that, in effect, they are running the risk, at least in some areas, within this limited time period at least, of sawing off the branch that they're sitting on. That by directly or indirectly contributing to the hollowing out of the international system in various different ways, they will also, at least in some fields, achieve something that they do not, at least necessarily in a direct and conscious way, hope to achieve. Of course, there are problems and tensions there with the overall realist interpretation of Chinese foreign policy. But this is something I encountered very much during the recent LSE Asia Forum in Beijing, where the present foreign minister, Yang Jiechi, gave the most strikingly liberal interpretation of Chinese foreign policy that I think I ever heard. Now, he was speaking to, he's an LSE graduate, he was speaking to an LSE audience. He may have misjudged the LSE audience for what I know. But at least he wanted to present the liberal view. The problem with that speech, it was a grand speech, I enjoyed it very much, but it had absolutely no strategic perspectives built into it. There was nothing in it about what China really wanted to see or wanted to achieve, except, as you just put it, François, that China wanted to go along with more and more and more of what they were starting to understand the international system to be. Now, of course, that could be as dangerous, if you go back to put a realist twist on it, than the perspectives that you just laid out. So I'm wondering about your perspectives on this. Is there anything within that limited time period, let's not talk about the far future, but within the intermediate period, that you see as a specific Chinese strategy to achieve specific aims within the kind of policy that they are trying to draw up now? Or is it, whatever spin you put on it, the more for us within the existing system approach?
Thanks. Shall I answer now?
Yeah, I think you should.
That's a very tough question. And I want to repeat that I don't think that, how should I put it? I don't think that Yang Jiechi is lying and that Dai Bingbo is saying the truth when privately he's much more cynical and realist and expresses, you know, things in quasi-19th century geopolitical style. Again, I spoke about the, not the pluralistic, but the diverse trends, and they're all there. And Yang Jiechi, or his brother, in fact, in Shanghai, are ultimate inheritors of this liberal diplomatic tradition within the communist system. To some extent, they may be used, of course, but to some extent, they absolutely believe in it. What I think we have is an insurance strategy and a hedging strategy at the top of the leadership between joining the integral the international system and contributing just enough and sometimes a little more when you're in competition and balancing this, hedging this with a bilateral approach which is an extension of neighborly relations and tributary relations, if one really wants to, yep, to use that word, which is less risky or is felt to be less offensive to the principle of the Chinese system, requires less change, but in my view is much more risky in a traditional geopolitical way when you lend a lot of money to Russia or even a lot of money to Brazil, in fact, and make 25 years gas deals. You don't know whether those guys will live up to their deals in the next 25 years. So, but it's not a systemic risk. It's an actual geopolitical risk. Just as, you know, lending $23 billion to build refineries in the Democratic Republic of Congo or Nigeria, I forgot which one of the two was announced. So it's hedging your bets. The Chinese have this uncanny ability to appear to be doing more than what they do. Since the beginning of the world crisis, I was thunderstruck by the London G20 summit, where they seemed to be the savior appearing out of darkness, when in fact Japan was putting so much more on the table and not even getting a line in the FT or in the Times to take those examples. In East Asia, however, China will compete with Japan dollar for dollar, to appear to be as influential, so different attitude, different place. When I look at some people call the pattern of internationalization of the renminbi, for example, I'm struck by the fact that this is not something that is leading to conventional internationalization. It's bilateral extension, which has a mercantilist flavor to it. It's the slow introduction of some instruments, and it's a modest raise in international quotas. Now, the Chinese can be very useful, very skilled in using the restrictions or the limitation placed on their role by saying, well, this is why, you know, no taxation without responsibility, and we haven't got yet enough, so we are not more contributive. I'm not sure they are pushing so strongly for a wider shareholding rights, for example, and for more contribution. I think they stay under that level in international organizations, international financial organizations, for example, IMF or BAD or AADB or others. So part of it is a form of international contribution. It's more limited than people think. Part of it is hedging. Part of it, I think, is uncontrolled, thoroughly uncontrolled, because the money flows are really thoroughly uncontrolled, are part of the Sino-American crisis and what to do with it. I do not pretend to have a strategic explanation to the fact that China doesn't stop, but really goes down on its level of purchase of US dollar instruments at the end of 2009, the beginning of 2010, and everybody starts writing op-eds on, there it is, they're giving up on the US, they're threatening the US. 4 months later, we see China coming back actively in the market, and the statistics for dollar purchases increasing more than ever. That's not a strategy. It's helplessness within a global system that's gone astray. And so to some extent, there is no strategy. But I think in this, I mean, I'm perhaps using the financial and economic test case, we can say that just as in other areas, the Chinese are hedging and placing different bets at the same time, hoping to ride through, hoping not to be noticed too much, hoping not to be asked too much, and growing, almost in spite of themselves on the international scene. Now, what I just said is a little outlandish because there is also a lot of pride. So there's been also a lot of fairly haughty behavior on the part of Chinese leaders, and the body language is has clearly changed a lot, and they can't help themselves clearly having that body language. But I don't think it reflects a very well thought out strategy. I don't know if I've answered that.
Very good, Robert. Perfect timing for your question, I'm sure. Robert Wayne.
Indeed. Just let me mention one particular point on which pushes in the direction of China not wanting to lead. In 2005, the World Bank carried out a major price survey of many countries in order to recalculate GDPs and also poverty. First time ever, China allowed this international price survey to be done in China. Previously, the figures, the PPP, purchasing power parity figures for China, and therefore also estimates of the extreme poverty headcount of people in extreme poverty in China compared to other countries, was all based on sort of econometrics. There were no statistics from China. So this was a big breakthrough. But the Chinese Statistical Office put restrictions on the price survey, which were almost guaranteed to produce the result that prices in China, quote unquote, were much higher than had previously been estimated. Therefore, China's GDP was much, in purchasing power parity terms, was much lower. And there were hundreds of millions of people in extreme poverty in China, more than had previously been. It seems to me very likely that the Chinese authorities knew perfectly well that by placing restrictions such as saying that the price surveys could only be done in cities, not rural areas, and only 11 cities, they knew full well that this would guarantee these results to make China look much poorer than previously we thought. Therefore, this was in the run-up to Copenhagen and so on. Therefore, that China couldn't be asked to bear the responsibilities of a middle-income country. So that kind of pushes, it's just an illustration of one part of your argument. However, I wanted to just ask you, really continuing on from that, do you have much sense of how China is operating within the G20, for example, in terms of its relations with Brazil, with India, with South Africa, with Russia, the BRICS? to kind of ride two horses in the same kind of way, both to lead and not lead within the G20? Is it simply signing up to the G7 agenda for the G20, or is it trying to lead a group of other countries to in some way modify the G7 agenda for the G20?
Okay. Let you all answer that one, François, and then I'll take a few questions. Yeah.
On your
brief.
On your remark about GDP per capita, I'm always reminded, I think it was in 1978 that China published its first GDP per capita statistic. It was, if I recall, $273, which was $1 lower than India. And that was consciously set so that, you know, it would be the floor for international subsidies from World Bank. So it's an old... That is indeed an old tradition. On China and the G20, it's a very difficult question. Again, we used to think of China as posturing as a South country within a group of 77 nations and, in fact, enjoying some advantages of an industrialized nation of a much stronger economy. Today, I think we have to look at its attitude to the BRICS, because that's what it really means. I mean, you know, it's Brazil or India, as case-by-case, tactical, coalition-forming, but without the sense of a longer-term strategy that, you know, Goldman Sachs publications would like us to believe from their descriptions of the emerging countries as one big dynamic club. And that is an important qualification to make. I have a friend who specializes in WTO negotiations, however, and his favorite motto about WTO negotiation is it's the coalition that lasts 15 minutes more than the other guys that wins. So, you know, opportunism and tactical behavior on some fronts can make a lot of sense, and so we should look carefully at how China and India or China or Brazil act. There's been, however, there have been obvious cases of disagreement in India and China. It's not only security purposes. They have allied each other. I would argue that they have allied each other on climate, and that's been the leading coalition leading up to Copenhagen. With Obama's hesitations and doubts, you know, coming in at the last moment to feed that alliance. But on the other hand, India has come on very strongly on the monetary front, very strongly requesting for revaluation of the renminbi. When I look at that, I'm not even sure I believe our Indian friends. I'm not sure what they're not talking is quid pro quo. You know, we helped you on climate, we're now expecting returns on security, and all hell will break loose, and we know how to be obnoxious. So I don't have a final word, but to answer you, coalitions, opportunistic, but not a common strategy.
I'll do a couple on this side. Barry Boussard.
Right, thanks, François. I've got two questions, really. One is, I'm puzzled by the line you're trying to tell us that China is kind of deeply, profoundly, permanently, always realist. But on the other hand, they're making up as they go along. These two things don't add up for me. If you're a deeply, profoundly, and permanently realist, then you've got a plan, right? And you know exactly what game you're playing, and you can pretty much work out what it is you've got to do. If you're making it up as you go along, you're not a realist, it seems to me. So I'm not quite sure how you're adding these two things up. The other point is... like a good realist, of course, you have to come to a gloomy conclusion. That's what realists do. So you say, you know, China will be badly off and the rest of us will be badly off if, as you call it, the system. I think you're actually talking about international society here, because you can't escape from the system, but you can escape from the society. You seem to think this would be a terribly bad thing, but you didn't say why, whereas it seems to me quite a good case can be made that it's actually rather a good thing. The Western-dominated system is coming to an end, almost unquestionably. I think it hasn't been very successful the last little while anyway. If you say China is a big, inward-looking, self-concerned part of this system? Well, hey, that reminds me of the EU quite a lot, and of the way the United States used to be before it got over-engaged in the rest of the world. What would be wrong with a more decentered international society, a kind of pluralism of regions, if you will, going back a little further to the times that you were talking about earlier? That's the kind of world we had in the classical world, except it wasn't as interconnected as it is now. But why shouldn't that work quite well? Regional variations. We agree on quite a lot. We agree on sovereignty and, broadly speaking, on non-intervention and elements of the market, nationalism. We agree on enough to be able to run a more decentered world order than the one we've got now. And the one we've got now is not very pretty anyway, so why are you so keen about it?
That's such a direct challenge, Frank, that I have to let you answer that right away.
Realism versus opportunism. If you're strong, your realism is going to be persistent and permanent. If you perceive yourself as weak, and I do maintain that the Chinese leaders have a sense of themselves, which is not our sense of their strengths, you will be very strong, you will be very realist, you will be very persistent in areas where you know you have to defend yourself, so there won't be any inconsistency on so-called core interests, Taiwan. On the rest, you will be navigating because precisely you feel you have to have your own priorities, you feel you're vulnerable in other areas, and you're going to be a lot more opportunistic. You won't feel self-assured. So that would deserve a lot more debate. But again, the contradiction of the early 20s in Japan looks very much like the contradiction which you've just pointed out. Now, the second question is so philosophical and political, it's an entirely deserved question, but it opens up a world, an abyss, so to speak. What I believe is that the international system and rules that we have are the worst except any other system, even though, you know, challenges of double standards, challenges of hypocrisy, what a former LSE president would have called the institutionalization of doubt. I guess he wrote a book about that, and it's the essence of our apprehension of the international system is there. We are doubters. You're talking about a return to a Westphalian order, essentially, by saying that, you know, there were customary relationships and trade-offs and balances which served a function as well as the kind of rigid and legally prescribed international system of above which we have today. I believe it would be extremely regressive. I believe, by the way, that part of the Chinese strategy has not been tested internationally in terms of security. For example, I'm waiting to see what will happen to Chinese interests and citizens in Africa if there is a steep downturn and a backlash. I'm not saying that Africans are about to kick Africans out now. They welcome them and would rather kick Chinese out. They would rather welcome them and kick out the former tradesmen who profited too much on Africa's back. So this is not, you know, it's not a paradigm for today. But by voiding the international system while having this huge financial and trade and people-based flows, they are like an absentee landlord. They will have a lot of difficulty, and we will all have a lot of difficulty should a problem arise. Should we welcome the Chinese downscaling of some aspects of the international system? Yes, when we were paying ourselves with words. That's what's happening with the European Union on some issues today. We saw in the UN the obligation to protect, for example, being degraded by ourselves within the UN. We hardly need the Chinese to be unable to enforce it. So if what I take what you're saying as truth is better than sham policies, then I would follow you. But I'm not as negative on the international system as it exists. This would deserve more discussion.
A lot more discussion. Good, it would be as well.
Clearly. Yes.
Svetozov, then Mr. Gao. We'll lump some together now.
First of all, thank you for this inspiring talk. And I would like to, in a way, follow up on various questions and on where you ended, in a way, describing China sitting on the sidelines. And to me, a very destabilizing factor in the prospect. But now I would like to ask you, as you said that China is becoming bigger and bigger and richer and richer, in a way despite itself, how do we cope with it? From the Chinese perspective now, looking at how can we and in what way can we cope with this? We cannot simply sit on the side.
Ah, we can't, no.
Six-party talks, the P5 plus Germany talks. I don't think it's a kind of issues relating to international system. For international system, it's NPT. NPT NPT is the focal point for the system. And now it seems you are focusing on Iran only, and also. On Iran issues, even on Iran issues, it seems that the traditional powers are more concerned about sanctions. But the fact is that sanctions didn't work, and we don't know.
What was the word?
Sanctions.
Okay, sorry. Yeah.
Sanctions didn't work before, yeah. And we don't know if new sanctions will work. And the other thing is about the RMB revaluation. Well, this is much more. Bilateral issues, but not global issues. It's issues between China and Europe, and also between China and the United States. You use these two examples to judge China's behavior. I think it's a kind of reflection of the frustration of traditional powers, and also it's because the rule of game is changing. The traditional power is given, cannot follow the traditional trajectories in engagement with China of give less and take more. But now if China ask for something to pay back for China's sacrifices, and you are not accustomed to that. So it's a kind of, I think it's a kind of a mentality. So how could you, what's your comment on the reaction and adaptation to that change?
Okay. We have one more question over there. Let's take that. Let me just actually add to what you said, Gao, before I turn it over to them. On the revaluation issue, I've just written on this. If there was a short-sighted approach to dealing with bilateral affairs, not to mention international affairs, in terms of the global financial system, monetary system, it must be Chinese currency revaluation. And the United States currently has a trade deficit with 93 countries. believing that a change in the value of the renminbi would help strategically with this in the longer run is beyond the fantasy, but that's my view. Yes, please.
So I think you're exactly right in saying that the extent to which China behaves like a realist power depends really fundamentally on the extent to which it thinks the United States especially is powerful, on its perception of its own relative influence. But I think that the analysis needs something added to it, which is that if you're right that groups in the Communist Party factions aren't so important anymore, I think that the sort of groupings of different views are still vital in the People's Liberation Army and in groups of public intellectuals. In these two groups, people who have wanted to see China take a sort of robust strategic stance towards the United States have always existed, and sometimes they've been loud voices, like in the 96 Taiwan Straits crisis or the occupation of the Institute of Freedom. But in both of those cases, what allowed the civilian leadership to reassert itself against these voices was a robust US military stance, sending in an aircraft carrier in the Taiwan Straits crisis. Recently, I think these voices have got louder. If you look at PLA doctrine, you can see this in the recent harassment of Japanese ships, for example. If you look at public academics, you can see it in the rise of an individual like Lai Jiangwen, whose analysis of the idea that China should adopt a sort of peace program of naval expansion is based on the idea that the US is in decline. And so if I'm right, the perceptions of US power relative to China are sort of vital here, is there a way that the US can adjust this? Does building a sort of cooperative relationship with China in the future really fundamentally depend on the US taking a very robust stance now, and can that be done?
Thank you. Very good.
Lots of questions, and I should have noted the first one because I'm missing it. Now, I'll start by the last
sure.
questions. Maybe that's easier and work my way back. Always very hard to say whether a particular incident is controlled or semi-uncontrolled. You get lots of people who will explain to you it's those PLA hotheads. As a way, that's part of the public diplomacy system. It's a complementarity between the explainers and the doers. And Wei Qiaobu people are very much in the category of explainers. What the US can do, in my view, not much. That's where I share, I suppose, Barry presents implicit vision of the future. When I said the Europeanization of the US, I mean that we have got to the end of the imperial overstretch. We've got to the overburdening of the load. There's only that many crises that the U.S. can take. And if North Korea can afford to sink a South Korean frigate without fear, given the condition it's in some other ways, it's a sure sign that many people are making that bet. And it's an important part of the East Asia figure. It's also one of the reasons why in Japan, I think, change of coalition, political opening to China and so forth is not giving a lot of results. Because I think in a realistic way, the Chinese know they can press for more and that they can count on democratic instability. So I am indeed, from a realistic point of view, as Barry said, pessimistic. And I know all my U.S. friends, American friends, keep telling that democracies have resolved and rise up again, and that the U.S. have always kicked the bottom of the swimming pool and come back up in any kind of crisis, but this one is more difficult than any others. So that is important. Coming back to your arguments. Your arguments are, of course, technically excellent. That you cannot consider the Iranian issue outside of the overall NPT and NPT violation framework and so forth. The problem is when we've said everything is related to everything else, you still have to start somewhere and to do something. And in general, not only on Iran, but when you mentioned Six Party, I thought you were going to move back to the Korean issue. In general, China is... I finished my sentence.
Also, our NPT issues, I remember China is... China do have reservations on the lifting of the ban by
Yes, I know.
Yeah, last time.
Yes.
So that's a kind of good behavior or bad behavior in terms of the stability
okay.
of the system.
All right.
It's going to be a big debate. Renminbi reevaluation, India again protested. That's not the US or the EU. I share Arne's view on the Renminbi, you know, moving the savings consuming equation in China is more important than a revaluation. We all know that. However, revaluations have always been done as what a would cause stopgap short-term measures
political
to mitigate their political...
On
us having to get used to our decline, which is how I translate what you say, yes, the answer is yes. We have to become used to the fact that we can no longer bear the international order as we built it, and that it's going to weaken, or it's going to fragment, or it's going to be replaced. So the reason I'm looking at the hollowing out factor is that I'm concerned by what will replace it, but what kind of contribution, what kind of aims are there. And I don't find that China is out to dominate the international order. I find that China is not very much concerned, is very passive, is not very contributive, which is a different tack. And therefore, when you implicitly say you will be replaced by newer and stronger and more efficient people, I say no. The problem is maybe we won't be replaced within the international order, and certainly not by China in many areas where it just does not want to be bothered. But we again, the argument could go on, and I think I've understood your point. What was the
European strategy with regard to China's development? Let's not say it right.
For Europeans, I mean, we've, you know, this is part of an EU-China report by the ECFR, by the way, the part of China Bureau did, which the ECFR published a year ago, which I co-wrote. We gave everything out front in the beginning. So the opening of the market, lots of stuff. So we have much less to bargain with. And this is the problem. We're much less coordinated than the US, Department of Commerce, Special Representative for Trade, and so forth. And we're also much less threatened directly than the US because we make an overall surplus. And even to the end of last year, you'll find in Brussels people saying, yeah, but we make it up with third countries, and so forth. It's no source for concern. In fact, the walls are coming nearer. My solution is not aggressive. To this, I think we should have open discussion, but at the EU level, one of the problems is the cut with Britain, of course, and the distrust within EU members about Chinese investment. When you have such an imbalance as the one you see, the only answer is investment. The problem, of course, is it has to be discussed, and it should not be, you know, a new race, a competitive race by countries to draw out investment. But there is a grand bargain to be struck. In a way, the US struck a grand bargain through the purchase of US T-bond or other debt instruments. It's a deal that's backfiring now in some respects, but it's a deal.
And what is the grand bargain with Europe?
With grand bargain, I think it's not closing the door of protectionism, you know, or so forth, although instruments can be used when things are too unfair, shall we say, when the situation is absolutely not reciprocal. But I think we need a bargain on investment. I think, and this touches on all the things we see in the papers about the Eurobond issue, about the need for public financing and so forth. And of course, the worst possible moment for Europe to ask the question to China is the moment when it has a debt crisis and a monetary crisis on its hands. I'm not suggesting we do it now. I'm not suggesting that Greece 6 months ago should have borrowed 25 billion of Chinese cash, as Goldman Sachs was quite willing to procure for Greece. That would have been the wrong move, the wrong signal, shall we say. But in better times, in more quiet times for European monetary and financial issues, I think we have to negotiate. And part of it is an opening to China. The problem is that the previous opening we hardly negotiated, we gave. I mean, I could discuss much more in detail that aspect.
We will have many chances to get back to some of the questions that were asked here and some of the issues that François brought up in his excellent presentation to start with. We are hoping that we will be able to develop, if not a program, at least a form of concerted dialogue with the Asia Center in Paris with regard to China issues, with regard to regional issues for East Asia. We hope we will, if we are very lucky, we will be getting going with that next year, so there is something that we can really put into pursuing jointly some of the very important issues that you have brought up tonight for us. So I want to thank you on behalf of all of us for an excellent presentation and for taking time to answer our questions, and I look forward to a further cooperation on this and other issues. Thank you very much.